Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Shortly after the start of the new year, the Surgeon General issued a warning about the cancer risk of consuming alcohol. Apparently, it contributes to about 100,000 cancer cases every year. The announcement has made some wonder about the wisdom of taking even one drink. But there are other concerns surrounding alcohol because of its addictive qualities. One of the industries whose workers often struggle with alcohol addiction are those in the food service industry. It's a business fueled by high stress, fast-paced environments, late hours, and unconventional sleep schedules. All of that can make workers in that field susceptible to alcohol and drug addiction. In fact, a 2015 study by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says the food service and hospitality industry has the highest rates of substance use disorders and the third highest rates of heavy alcohol use of all employment sectors. Charlotte chef Sam Dimenich knows all about that. And when Hopeway, a local behavioral and mental health treatment facility in Charlotte, began to focus on food as medicine in their efforts to help break the cycle of addiction, Dimenich teamed up with them. So this hour, we're going to look at this concept of food as medicine, the latest on the safety of alcohol consumption, and more. Chef Sam Dimenich is with us. He's the owner of Your Farms, Your Table, which works to support local farmers and is also the executive chef at Restaurant Constance. He's here along with Dr. Allison Karoski-Mazey. She's CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hopeway. And Mickey Baxt is a retired member of the hospitality industry and co-founder and executive director of Ben's Friends. That's a group of food and beverage professionals who have found or who are seeking sobriety. Thank you all for being here. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's radio. Good morning. We have to talk. Good morning. We're going to explore several different semi-related topics over the course of this hour: sobriety in the food industry, the health dangers of alcohol consumption, as recently outlined by the Surgeon General, and the idea of food as medicine. But let's start with sobriety. Sam, both you and Mickey have had your own journeys toward sobriety. And I mentioned the high-stress nature of the hospitality business a moment ago, but workers in a lot of businesses face similar pressures. Why are hospitality workers more prone to alcohol and drug addiction, Sam?
Well, that is something that has been normalized in our industry almost since its inception, you know. And so, like, for my story, you know, I was raised in a restaurant family. My grandfather's a chef, my dad was a chef, you know, and so that's essentially where I spent the majority of my childhood, you know, in the restaurant. And because I loved it, I love the atmosphere, I love the spirit of collaboration and taking care of people. That's also where I got my education in alcohol and drugs, because it was normal to drink while you were cooking, and it was normal to take a break either between shifts or after the shift, you know, and get high like that. You know, that was just the way it was. It wasn't uncommon. And so you know, that's a small kind of snapshot of what those of us that are sober and in the hospitality industry are kind of working against. And for the fact that the industry can be predatory, the fact that it can be an easy place to hide out because of the, like, the chaotic lifestyles that we have if you're an alcoholic or an addict. I could go on and on, but that's a big reason why, Ben's Friends exist.
If you watch all those television shows about cooking in the restaurant business, like Top Chef and others, Bobby Flay, I think, is one of them. And of course, The Bear, you can see how intense it can be, I suppose. Mickey, you spent 48 years in the restaurant business before you retired. You spent 42 of those 48 years sober. So give me your take on why restaurant workers appear to be more prone to substance abuse.
Well, thanks, Mike. And I echo everything Sam said, but I also add, we're in an industry that we are watching people celebrate. There is an attitude in restaurants of celebration. People go there for occasions. People go there for entertainment. And so all evening long, you're entertaining people, whether you're in the back or the front of the house. You're in the spirit where you're entertaining and catering to people, which is a feeling of celebration, in my opinion. The other thing is you're completely surrounded by alcohol. You have alcohol everywhere you turn, whether you're in the kitchen, going into the walk-in, grabbing a wine for a stock, or you're in the front of the house serving drinks, you're surrounding them. And then I think one of the most important things is think about this. Most people work 9 to 5, they get off work, they have 5, 6 hours to unwind. Restaurant people who work nights get off at 11, 12, 1, 2, 3 in the morning. Everything's closed. There's nowhere to go. There's no way to unwind. In my 42 years of sobriety working in restaurants, I couldn't fall asleep for 2 hours after working, no matter what time it was. And so people have nowhere to go, nothing to do. And so that let's drink, let's drug, let's sort of calm ourselves down becomes part of the culture.
Doctor, you're the CEO and Chief Medical Officer for Hopeway, which helps people toward mental health, mental wellness, let's put it that way, from many different challenges that these folks may face. It's not just alcoholism or drug addiction. You don't just concentrate on those things. But what is it about the food and beverage industry? Sam mentioned he was attracted to the pace and the lifestyle of what was happening in the back of the house, in the kitchens, as a person growing up in the restaurant business. Does this business attract a certain kind of personality that might tend toward an addictive personality?
I'm not sure about that, but I think Mickey brings a good point about access, right? If alcohol is at the bar and being served and being used in the food, it's really hard to maintain sobriety when a trigger, which is the alcohol, is in your face all day. So I think it is a combination of access, having not a lot of resources after hours to do other things. I mean, think about COVID when we were isolated and there wasn't as much to do, more people drank. So I do think that Mickey has really good points about the why. Of course, a lot of people do use alcohol or other substances to kind of calm down or to try and relax. And so if you are in any stressful industry, whether it's law or medicine or the kitchen, a lot of people have that same challenge.
So what you're saying, and I know Mickey wants to talk about this, but what you're saying is that you don't necessarily have to have a predilection toward being an addictive personality or somebody who might succumb to that in order to be in that business and develop that over time because of the stresses that we're talking about. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, there is a genetic component to alcoholism. So if you come from
Sure.
a family of people that are heavy drinkers, you are at an increased risk. But I also think Sam's right that when you grow up around alcohol and that's normalized and you're drinking with your parents or your grandparents and you're 15, 16, 18, it's just seen different. And I think that contributes mainly.
Mickey.
I had my first drug and alcohol overdose long before I got into restaurants. But when I got into restaurants, I found a place where my behavior was not unusual. It was actually accepted. And then you have a whole lot of young people come into restaurants. They're in college. They're playing a lot. They don't know what they want to do, and they're introduced to a culture that is about partying. So that encourages a lot of people, and those who are those who are, what's the word, subject to addictions, they easily find a place where they can nourish their addiction without. I used to pass out behind my bar. I own the bar, The cleaners would find me at 6 o'clock in the morning on a rubber mat. Everybody knew about it, but nobody thought twice about it. And that is part of what our industry is. It has been for years.
I want to hear your personal stories, the two of you. Sam, you grew up in the restaurant business, you said, and your personal journey with addiction led you through a period of homelessness for about a year and a half. But your addiction wasn't just alcohol, it was also to harder drugs as well. What were you on?
Well, so, you know, the homelessness part, that was a consequence of my actions. So I have to qualify that as well. Just from an early age, again, like going back to the restaurant days, the people that were working the line, my dad included, my uncles included, those were people I looked up to. You know, they were great cooks. I thought of, almost of them like culinary heroes, and I wanted to be like them. And so in my like young, undeveloped mind, you know, I connected this, this formula here where it's like, we're doing incredible things in the restaurant, make a lot of people happy. And then rewarding ourselves with drugs and alcohol, you know, and so that's really where it all began. And, you know, there's family dysfunction issues in my story, I got injured when I was young and I was prescribed opiates. I'm a part of the opiate epidemic, generation. And here's the thing, man. And it's one of those things that's I think, individual specific is like, I had plenty of opportunities to get sober. You know, and I went to a lot of treatment centers and a lot of detoxes, and a lot of people told me what I needed to hear. You know, I just wasn't ready to do it until I was. And they say pain is the cover charge to recovery. You know, and so it took what it took.
What I was going to ask you, what flipped the switch? Because to support your habit, you say at one point you did unlawful things. When you slept in gas station bathrooms or in a chair at the emergency room at a local hospital. Was there a moment, was there an event that happened? Was there something that occurred that made you realize this can't continue?
Yeah, I didn't want to die, honestly. And I had no intention of getting sober because I didn't think I was a candidate for it, you know, which is a big reason why I'm so compelled to help others now. And, it was a situation where I was just doing unlawful things in unlawful areas, and my life was on the line, you know. And so when I made the call to get out of Charlotte, it wasn't because I had big dreams of getting sober and opening a restaurant and working with Dr. Allison 10 years later. You know, it was like, I don't want to die. I don't want my kids going to my funeral. You know, and said that was that. And then what happened was I got into a safe place with people that understood recovery. And I was just smart enough to realize, like, maybe I should try something different. Yeah. Maybe I don't have it all figured out because I thought I did.
Allison, I have about a minute left. Go ahead. I know you want to jump in here.
Sure. I think it's really hard to change behavior. And when you get into patterns and habits, it's really, really difficult to change that. So oftentimes, until you hit rock bottom, until things are so bad that you don't want to die and you have no other choice, behavior doesn't change. And so we see that as a very common challenge in helping people maintain recovery.
If the high intensity atmosphere of the restaurant business and the fact that you need to unwind every day after that ends, and you've got very few choices where to do that because you're working night shift and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and nothing is open. If that is a problem, it seems to me that you'd want to get away from that industry and find something else to pursue. You did not do that, Sam. And in fact, you went from the frying pan after that period of homelessness back into the frying pan. We'll talk about that in a moment when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about alcohol, addiction, the restaurant business, the intersection of the two things. We're talking about the Surgeon General's recent report saying that even one drink can be unhealthy. And we're going to talk about food as medicine as we go through this hour with Sam Dimenich. He's the owner of Your Farms, Your Table and the executive chef at Restaurant Constance. Mickey Baxt spent 48 years in the restaurant business. He's retired now, but he's the co-founder and executive director of an organization called Ben's Friends, which helps others in the restaurant business deal with the recovery and sobriety. And Dr. Allison Kurowski-Mazey is the CEO and chief medical officer of Hopeway, an organization dedicating to help people toward mental health. Sam, you went through this very dark period in your life, which we've talked about, and you come back from being homeless and isolated from your family. And in just a few short years after that, you're competing on the competition show Beat Bobby Flay. And you're back working in high-pressure restaurants, high-end restaurants. What was your path to sobriety? And did you worry that returning to that atmosphere was going to put it all at risk?
Those are long years, man. Hey, yeah, the journey to recovery, it kind of went like this. You know, I was in a treatment center called Any Length Recovery down in Sumter, South Carolina. And it's a long-term treatment center, year, 18 months, stays like that. And I can recall specifically, like, to the day, I can still smell the air. I had been there for about 5 months, 6 months, something like that, and not a drug or drink in my system. You know, and I thought I had a comprehensive understanding of what the word sobriety meant. But I was so miserable and I was dying inside. And I remember we had a meeting every day, and I went to that meeting and I went back to my room and just fell apart, you know, and just wept and just essentially just surrendered. I'll do whatever it takes. This is either going to go one way or the other. I'm either going to drink again, or I'm going to try what all of these people are suggesting that I do, you know, and that's surrender to my reality and, you know, and hopefully forge a new path forward. And so that was the beginning of it. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for the people that propped me up and that I was able to lean into at the time. But part of that program required me to have a job. And that's the beauty of this treatment center. And so I got a job in food and beverage, and I literally had to relearn everything, Mike. I'd been out of the industry for several years at that point. I really had to relearn how to taste food and how to cook and how to saute and all the timing and thing that the tools that we use in the kitchen. And so I was hesitant. I wasn't sure. I was told many, many times that you can't stay sober and cook, man. You know, it just doesn't work like that, you know? And so, you know, sell insurance, you know, play golf. I was hearing all these different suggestions, you know, but the people that that I loved and still loved and believed in said, man, if you do this thing called recovery, you can do whatever you want, you know, whatever you want, you know? And I said, well, I love to cook. It's all I've ever done. It's all I've ever known. And they said, well, as long as you prioritize recovery first, whatever happens after that, you know, is fair game. And so what I'd always done before is that I always put, like, anytime I would try to get sober in the past, it was always like cooking, kids, my wife at the time. And then, you know, I'd catch a meeting. It would be somewhere down here. Right. You know what I mean? And so what I had to do is really just flip how I viewed my priorities and all that. And so once I did that, the rest is history, man. And I just started out at one of the worst restaurants I've ever worked in my entire life. It was a very humble beginning. And then soon after that, I landed in a place called Hamptons in Sumter, South Carolina, a fine dining restaurant. And what's cool about that place, and again, it's like one of those God-shot moments where everything I was hearing in recovery, I was experiencing by the management and the leadership in the restaurant. And so onward we went.
Ben, you also are, Mickey rather, you're a recovering alcoholic, 42 years sober, and the co-founder of Ben's Friends, which you co-founded with another restaurateur who runs about two dozen, I'm told, restaurants in the Southeast. He too has problems with addiction. Ben's Friends focuses on helping workers in your industry get and stay sober. You started in Charleston. You have expanded that since then to about 15 or more cities. But why did you see the need for another organization that deals with this? I mean, there's Alcoholics Anonymous deals with this. Why was there a need for your organization?
You know, I got sober in AA. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. The thing was that it took me 6 years of going to AA back and forth, because I was a 24-year-old restaurant person. I lived a life different than the people who all looked like me. And for your audience, I'm a 72-year-old white guy. That's all that was in AA at the time. And they all told me, as Sam said, that you cannot go back into the industry. When I got sober, I had three best friends left, only three. One was alcohol, one was drugs, and one was my restaurant life, because I loved what I did. So AA was great. I encourage people to go there, but many young restaurant people go there and they don't connect right away. There are parts of AA that might be too strict. There are parts that might be too religious. There are parts that just don't fit. So we realized that restaurant people were going, not connecting, and then going back out and dying.
And your partner in this says that AA, for all of its good qualities, because he too has been to AA and used their program to cure his problem, that this is an organization, Ben's Friends is an organization that understands the industry and the people in it, which are different than your run-of-the-mill people who may go to AA, which may include lawyers and housewives and others. These are people who have a commonality that they have to deal with, correct?
Oh, there's no question about it. Sam said something about, you know, how people said you can't do it. Well, we believe you can do it. And we are a group of like-minded people who not only share the addiction, but we share the passion for the industry. And so we're there and we're able to say, yes, you can do it. And so somebody comes in and they see a chef like Sam, or they see a bartender who's sober. They realize there's hope for them in the industry.
Yeah.
And it works really quite well. And by the way, we're in 26 cities around the country. We have Zoom meetings. We have Zoom meetings every day that are now attended by people from not just the U.S., but Canada and Europe. And it's all restaurant people. So there's a commonality there above and beyond the addiction.
Allison.
I really love what Mickey and Sam are saying, because oftentimes you hear avoid people, places, and things. And, you know, if you're passionate about something, say it's cooking, and someone takes that away from you and says, go work in the insurance industry, well, that's not going to work, right? So I love what Mickey's doing and saying, like, okay, you can be sober and you can maintain your recovery if you prioritize that as number one, but still do what you love, which then protects people from depression and other things that could come from not doing what you love. And I think that message is not told enough. I think, you know, Mickey's right. There's a lot of rigidity in the industry and, you know, looking at how to best support the whole person, including what they want and enjoy in life, is really important.
Let's talk about your organization for a second, Allison. Hopeway works on helping people achieve mental health, but it seems to focus a lot on eating disorders. Are there similarities between those who suffer from eating disorders and those who have compulsions that lead to substance abuse?
So Hopeway is a mental health organization, and we have every level of care. So residential from 24/7 care to outpatient work. We serve adults and children. But the main thing that I brought to Hopeway when we started was looking at the medical, the psychiatric, and the substance use disorders. Because a lot of places look at the substance use disorders or they look at the mental health issues, but really you have to look at all of those issues to maintain recovery. And so some people may have an eating disorder and an alcohol use disorder, or someone might have bipolar disorder and an alcohol use disorder. And so looking at making a treatment plan for all of those issues is what's really important. And so looking at eating disorders. That is a completely different beast. But you may have somebody, even a young teen, who is misusing alcohol, also has anxiety and depression, and is has an eating disorder. And so looking at treating all of those issues with very specific modalities is important. And that's what we do at Hopeway, is we look at the whole person, and we look at the medical issues, the psychiatric issues, and the substance use disorders, and make a plan for recovery.
I said at the beginning I wanted to talk about three different things that surround alcohol, and one of them is our recent reports from organizations saying you shouldn't be touching the stuff, essentially. Not everybody drinks to excess. Not everybody becomes addicted to alcohol or drugs. Some people drink to be sociable. Some people drink because they like the taste. And for a while, we were told that having a glass of wine every day was good for you. Now we're being told the opposite is true. A federal study released this month says that among both men and women, drinking just one alcoholic beverage a day increases the risk of cirrhosis of the liver, esophageal cancer, oral cancer, and injuries of various kinds. Drinking two drinks a day increases the odds of death caused by alcohol for both genders. Doctor, what do you take from this? What should we take away from this? Which is right? You have a glass of wine every night because it's good for you, or you don't touch the stuff because it'll kill you?
Well, I think there's truth in some of all of this. You know, we've known for years that consuming alcohol can increase several types of cancers, including breast cancer in women, colon and rectal cancer, throat cancer, mouth cancer. But now what we're hearing is even one drink a week can increase your absolute risk of cancer in men and women. And so I think when we hear about the Mediterranean diet and you're thinking about, you know, fruits and vegetables and healthy fats and then maybe red wine, you know, if that's in moderation, that may be fine. But if someone's drinking regularly, whether it's one drink a night or two drinks a night or three drinks a night, you know, there are increased risks of all of those things, including cancer. And so I think you really need to look at that. And when we're looking at harm reduction, you know, if you are drinking every night, can you have the genetic makeup to be able to moderate that? Or you might not and have to maintain sobriety.
Are there differences in alcohol? In other words, there were supposed to be properties in red wine that were good for you. Maybe those same properties are not found in bourbon or a glass of beer or gin and tonic. Is that the case? Or once the body sees alcohol coming into its system, does it just see it as alcohol?
So right now, the news from the U.S. Surgeon General is looking at all alcohol being the same. I think there's been, you know, a lot of talk about red wine being potentially healthy. No one's ever talked about, you know, Jack Daniels being healthy. But, you know, is that true? Is that not true? I think we're learning a lot more about not only alcohol, but nutrition and everything that you put into your body, whether it's a food or a beverage, how that's affecting not only your body, but your brain. And I do think that the literature is really important for everybody to look at right now from the U.S. Surgeon General, because it is a problem. I think they're calling it out as a national problem. And I think all of us, including myself, probably need to look at what we're doing and how we're managing that.
And there's another recent study, I think it's from Harvard, that showed your photographs of your brain on alcohol, and alcohol shrinks your brain, evidently. Mickey, you wanted to chime in here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say something. I really don't know about food, and I'm not that good on it. I just was at the Science Museum in Chicago, and I believe 90% of the stuff we ingest in our system probably isn't healthy coming from the manufacturers. But I just want to point out that in regards to alcohol, for the alcoholic, there is no difference between wine, between bourbon, between gin. And that's something that needs to be pointed out regularly. You cannot go from drinking a pint of vodka to drinking a glass of wine if you're alcoholic and succeed. So I just, in this conversation, want to make that clear.
Doctor, in this latest report from the Surgeon General warning that alcohol consumption causes cancer, that came out this month, January. last month, December, a review by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, a non-governmental body, concluded that moderate drinking was linked to fewer heart attacks and stroke deaths, fewer deaths overall compared with no drinking. This gives credence to people who distrust science. Why should they trust it? Every other month, they contradict each other. During the pandemic, it was semi-understandable because we were dealing with a new virus that was mutating and we were dealing with it in real time. We didn't know what it was, how to cure it, how to deal with it, and the recommendations changed because they were figuring things out as they went along. We've been looking at alcohol forever. Why these conflicting reports month after month after month, and what are we supposed to do about it? Who do we trust?
Yeah, that's totally understandable. I think it's really challenging with research when, you know, you're looking at different numbers in terms of who's being evaluated and different studies and how those studies are being done, and it can be very confusing. We have known that alcohol increases cancer for years. I was a medical director at Fellowship Hall, and I don't even know how many years ago this was, but let's say 20, 15 years ago, I was lecturing about this. So this is not new information. You know, we have known this for a very long time, and I think that the report highlights the importance of looking at this. And I think Mickey brings up a good point when there's a difference between people who can socially drink and have that ability to do so and those who have an alcohol use disorder or alcoholism. And so you're talking about two different populations. Like one person might be able to socially have a glass of wine and somebody might not, because that one glass turns into six or seven or eight and then they black out. So
yes, when you're talking about addiction, but when you're not talking about people who are addicted, when they're just drinking socially and they can stop when they want to, one report says that's good for you. Fewer heart attacks, fewer stroke. Another says you're going to get cancer, you're going to die. It's not good for you. Don't touch the stuff. What am I supposed to do?
I think the overall concern is that alcohol can cause cancer. Alcohol can impact your cardiovascular health, other things as well. And so it is important. And if you are drinking one or two or three glasses a day, that is a lot, right? That's not socially drinking. And so if you're consuming alcohol daily, then that is going to cause challenges.
We're going to come back and talk just a little bit more about this, but then because you are what you eat, and therefore you are what you drink, we're going to talk about the concept of food as medicine. There's a big seminar about that very topic coming up in Chicago in June, food as medicine, but we'll talk about it here locally in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about alcohol. We're talking about alcoholism, recovering from it, alcohol use in the hospitality industry and the way to get around that. We're talking about whether alcohol should be consumed at all. And we're going to talk about food as medicine, and alcohol's something that you ingest, and therefore we'll take a look at that as well. With Sam Dimonich, he's owner of Your Farms, Your Table, and executive chef at Restaurant Constance. Mickey Baxt is co-founder and executive director of Ben's Friends, which helps people in the hospitality industry deal with addiction. And Dr. Allison Karosky-Mazey is the CEO and chief medical officer of Hopeway, a local organization that helps people toward mental health. One more question about what we were talking about just prior to the break, and then we'll move on. The Surgeon General, doctor, has issued his concerns about all of this, about alcohol being bad for you, in the form of an advisory, something reserved for public health challenges requiring immediate action. And he recommended adding these cancer warnings to alcoholic beverages, to the labels, like they do on cigarettes. Drinking this might cause cancer. First, do you see this as a public health challenge requiring immediate action? And second, do you think that warnings on beer bottles and liquor bottles, can they, will they make a difference?
I do see this as a major challenge that does need attention. I think that educating people on how alcohol may increase the risk for cancer is important. Do I think that warnings on bottles are going to change behavior? No, I don't. But, you know, we need to at least make sure we're informing the American public of what they are using.
You have said, Sam, on your road to recovery, that one of the reasons you decided it was time to stop and pursue being sober was you didn't want to die, and die from addiction and die from the side effects of addiction. But if you know that alcohol may lead to cancer, which can kill you, would that have been a strong enough motivating factor had you known it back then?
No. Not even close. I was a heroin addict. I was a crack addict. I wasn't worried about my Budweiser. But, okay. You know, to that point, I think it's fantastic. Like we're having this conversation, you know, and some of these research results are kind of revealing themselves. I have no issue with that. That's not particularly my space, but I'll celebrate it.
Go ahead.
I think it's important to note that, you know, how do you change behavior, right? And so for years, we've tried to scare people like teens about the risks of using alcohol, drugs, or tobacco. You know, we try and educate people. That doesn't really work, right? So we have to engage in therapeutic techniques like motivational interviewing or other ways to look at change and what someone's goals are and how can they get there. So it's more complicated than just educating the American public or scaring the American public, because like Sam said, no, just even if he knew this today, if he was an alcoholic, it wouldn't change his behavior.
So we ingest a lot of different things over the course of our lifetime. Over the course of a day, we ingest a lot of different things. And as Mickey pointed out, much of the stuff coming from manufacturers may not be good for us because it's processed food. You guys who work in the restaurant business, at least at high-end restaurants, one presumes that you're working with whole foods, although you might use a lot of butter, which is not good for you. But we're going to talk about the concept of food as medicine. Is this more than consuming, Sam, a balanced diet and eating your greens? Is it more than that?
Yeah, absolutely. But first, I have to say, if you're listening to this and you know, and you're seeking sobriety, my experience and many others is, you know, you remove the alcohol, your body's going to crave sugar. In comes the ice cream. Eat the ice cream. Eat the ice cream. You know, it's whatever it takes, man. And then I could just share some of my experience on my journey was this, you know, again, like, you know, I was in that treatment center and I had kind of that low bottom experience about 6 months into it. And soon after that, you know, I began to just consider my mental availability and my sustainability and my like physical sustainability. I'm lucky I had a sponsor who was health conscious and he suggested that I, you know, take a hard look at what I was putting into my body and ask the question whether or not everything that I'm going through to get sober, all this is the hardest thing I've ever done. I'll say it time and time again. You know, if you're going to do all this, then why not take a look at the physical element of my being? And Dr. Allison talks about it all the time, the whole self. And so soon after that, I walked away from soft drinks and I walked away from fast food and immediately saw results. And so that's a part of my like recovery DNA. And so really, it kind of surfaced itself and revealed this opportunity to kind of pay that, that notion forward during the pandemic, whenever we started Your Farms Your Table.
Doctor, you know, a lot of people who are not necessarily alcoholics use alcohol to self-medicate. A lot of people eat ice cream and other foods that's not necessarily great for you, might taste good, but they do that to self-medicate. That's food as medicine in the wrong direction. Would that be accurate?
Yes. You know, about 25% of Americans have a mental health issue throughout their life, right? And that can include anxiety, depression. And so what do people do when they're not feeling good, right? They seek things to increase dopamine, whether it's sugar or sex or, you know, alcohol or drugs. And so you can be addicted to sugar just as you are addicted to other things. And so Sam's right that if you try and cut out everything, that's just way too hard, right? So you can't expect that you're going to be able to stop using sugar, smoking, and alcohol all at the same time. Like, that's just way too hard. So if you're seeking recovery and working on alcohol or drug use, like, that's the priority. But many of us have bad relationships with food, or not bad, but not healthy, and misusing sugar or soft drinks or, you know, overeating or using ultra processed foods, those are all unhealthy habits.
There's another side to this idea of food as medicine, and I think it's one that Sam and others have tried to concentrate on. We do have this obesity problem in America, which is likely driven in part by what we eat and by the fact that a lot of people do not have access to fresh, wholesome, whole foods, not the grocery store, but the actual products. And during the pandemic, Sam, you saw a way to help farmers whose products weren't being sent to restaurants that had shuttered, and as a result, you started this organization called Your Farms, Your Table, to bring three-course meals to people's homes, but at an affordable price. In Charleston, Mickey, you run a program called Feed the Need. In 2009, you served more than three quarters, or since 2009, you've served more than three quarters of a million nutritious meals to disadvantaged people. So let me hear from both of you about the impact of access to healthy foods to those folks who don't have it. I'll start with you, Mickey, and then Sam, you take it up.
I'll make it really simple. There really isn't very much access to healthy food for those who are living in underserved populations. It's a wasteland. I'm part of an organization in an area of Charleston where there isn't a grocery store. The only place you can buy food is convenience stores, which is selling garbage. I mean, just actually garbage. There's no farms in the area. So you have to create consciously a chain of distribution to bring the food to the underserved. And that takes time, energy, and a true commitment. But that's what we've tried to do. We've tried to provide farmers with access to those that normally wouldn't have access. Mind you, not everybody wants that. Not everybody in those communities want that. You show them a bushel full of fresh vegetables or a couple of boxes of processed food, and I guarantee you 9 out of 10 are going to take the processed food. So it's a difficult, it's changing the mind, and we don't change minds easily.
Sam.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to kind of just jump back into the conversation about ice cream and all that stuff. Listen, brown sugar, cinnamon, Pop-Tarts help me get sober on a regular
Ben and
basis.
Jerry's.
Well, I didn't have access to that in rehab, Mickey. But then, whenever to your question, Mike, I have to say this. What I'm about to tell you isn't something that came up on my own. It's something that I learned from people like Mickey and Steve and and the people that have come before me in recovery, is that we got to stay in the solution, man. Perpetuating the problem gets nobody anywhere. And so when the pandemic happened and everything shut down, I was one of those chefs that just didn't see it coming, and I didn't have my particular finger on the pulse of what was happening, in the news cycle and all that stuff. And so I was just kind of blown away, and I was super sad, and I just didn't know what I would do next. And so I leaned into what I was trained to do, and that's like show up for myself, show up for each other in recovery, and stay in the solution. And so that's the beginning of what became Your Farms, Your Table. Get out of self and into service.
And Doctor, your organization, Hopeway, has also made what is described as an investment in serving good local food. You say that high quality, well-prepared food is often something that's overlooked, particularly at healthcare facilities due to budget cuts and other reasons. What kind of difference have you found this to make at Hopeway, where people are being fed really good food?
It makes all the difference. We are so excited to partner with Sam and Your Farms, Your Table to bring healthy, nutritious whole foods to our clients. And, you know, as we talked about treating the whole person, nutrition is key in all of this. And so, you know, the combination of therapy and potential medication management and support and exercise and good food and yoga and abstinence are all so important. And so I think we're going to see a really big, you know, robust change with moving into this direction.
And when we talk about good food and its impact not only on health but mental well-being, are we talking about it because the food is whole and nutritious and it's doing good things chemically inside our body because of what we are ingesting? Or are we talking about good food from the point of view that it was well-prepared, it looks good on the plate, it has ingredients that make it taste really phenomenal, and that makes you feel better? Which are we talking about?
So I think you'll feel better from having food that tastes good and looks good, but your body will respond well, both physically and mentally, from the nutrients and the vitamins in the fruits and the vegetables and the healthy fats and the protein. And so it's a combination of feeding your body and your brain while also having that immediate gratification of a really yummy, healthy meal. And also engaging with the people around you over that meal. As you know, many people with depression and mental health issues isolate or do not have the ability to maintain friendships or to have the energy for friendships. And so the community piece of this is really important as well.
I hesitate to bring up yet another study, but one of those studies you alluded to already that says that 25% of U.S. adults experience mental illness annually. And one of the contributing factors, apparently, is poor diet. It also says that whole food diets can reduce depression by up to 30%. Do you agree with that? And why does it work if you do agree with that?
Yeah, so there are a few studies that show that healthy whole foods and fruits, vegetables, nuts, beans, olive oil, fish, all of these things can improve symptoms of anxiety and depression because they may be decreasing inflammation in the body. They may be helping to restore the relationship between your gut and your brain. They also have the nutrients to prevent vitamin deficiencies, say vitamin B12, folate, vitamin D. All of these things can be off. And so we often also do blood work to see if somebody is deficient in some of these nutrients.
So in just a couple of minutes, go ahead, Mickey, go ahead quickly.
I also want to say I'm not an expert on food, and I don't pay much attention, to be honest, if you saw me. But I also want to say, in regards to why does it make you feel better, a lot of doing things that you know are good for you changes the mental aspect. You know, you think differently. And if you're depressed and you start doing something positive, like I'm going to eat healthier, I'm going to exercise, your brain reacts to that and the depression becomes maybe a little less, I would imagine. I also, if I may get one last word in, I don't know a lot about food, but here's what I do know. If you're struggling with addiction, don't worry about any of this. Just first get sober and then worry about your food and your diet and your physical being. First, you have to get sober for those struggling.
I just want to bring up the fact that in the last 30 seconds, Mickey has told us twice that he doesn't know a lot about food, but he served in some of the, worked in and ran some of the best restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina, which is a restaurant city. Yeah, it's a restaurant city. You don't survive there unless the food is good. The restaurant business, as we've talked about, and I only have a minute left, is difficult, but both of you stress, both you and Sam and Mickey stress, that you should offer grace to employees who are struggling with addiction, but be firm about it. So how do you strike the balance? Only have a minute left.
Go, Sam.
Yeah, so, I probably have about 20-25% of my staff, that for 45 people, in recovery. And I think there's strength in those numbers. But from a cultural standpoint, I think the way we kind of structured our communication abilities, our how we speak to each other. Like, we have this policy, we don't talk at anyone, we talk to each other. And that plays a big role in kind of freeing people up from not being able to share their true selves.
Sam Domenech is the owner of Your Farms Your Table, executive chef at Restaurant Constance. Mickey Baxt is the co-founder and executive director of Ben's Friends, which is an organization that helps people in the restaurant business toward recovering. And Dr. Allison Karosky-Mazey is the CEO and chief medical officer at Hopeway. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.